5, 4, 3, 2. You're tuned to 90.5 WICN, Jazz Plus for New England. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Listen online at WICN.org. Good evening, I'm Al Vohner, and this is The Public Eye. Nice to have you with us this Sunday evening. At some point in our lives, whether it was as a kid or an adult life, all of us have had a vaccination for one thing or another. But it continues right here in the year 2019 to be a hotly debated issue. Are they necessary? Are they really helping people? Who should implement them? A host of questions that I think many people still have in their minds. And as I said, it has become quite a contentious point as well. My guest this week is Bernice Hausman. She's the chair of the Department of Humanities at Penn State College of Medicine and the author of the new book, Anti-Vax, Reframing the Vaccination Controversy. Bernice, nice to have you with us.
Great to be on.
Did I sum it up right that to this day, here we are, because I remember back in the 50s, vaccinations for one smallpox or one thing or another, that continues today, but a lot of people are still not comfortable with the notion of vaccines, even though government agencies and medical personnel have said it's safe, it's good, it will protect you. What's the controversy?
Well, there are a couple of, I guess there's more than one controversy in a way, but the I guess one thing I would say is that we actually have very high rates of vaccination in the United States right now. So to a certain extent, most people in this country accept vaccination and comply with school entry mandates for their children and get vaccinations as adults. So it's not the case that we have a crisis, and it's not the case that we have large numbers of people refusing vaccines sort of overall across the country. At the same time, you do have parents nervous about vaccines for their children. And some of that is because in the 90s, the number of vaccines that children get skyrocketed, right? They developed more new vaccines, and then they were put into the schedule, and they were added to school entry mandates. So children get many more vaccines now than they used to. And that's one of the things that is fueling parental concerns.
I guess I'm trying to go back to the, you know, I was born in the mid-50s, and I remember in grammar school, it was never the school, at least not the school that I attended, but you know, my mother would quite often, at least annually, bring us to the family physician, and it was he or she who either recommended or suggested that, in fact, even implemented the vaccine. It's not quite that way anymore, is it?
Well, actually, depending on what you're sort of saying, that's not actually the way it is. So in the 1950s and the early 1960s, there were very few vaccines. Kids were vaccinated for smallpox. I was vaccinated for smallpox as well. That ended in 1970 in the United States. The polio vaccine, of course, was developed in the 1950s. And then in the 1960s, measles, mumps, and rubella vaccines were developed. Diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis vaccines also existed. So that was it. That was the complete grouping in the 1960s. And most children would have gotten vaccines at a doctor's office, although some were administered in schools. Like when I was a kid, they used to administer the rubella vaccine in schools. So you have, in this country, of course, you have a fragmented health system, right? You have public provision of vaccines, but it's through usually private doctor's offices, and it's paid for through public provision. So I'm not sure if that's getting at your question or not.
Well, you know, as you said earlier, I mean, you agreed that a lot of times it was issued, it was implemented by the, you know, local physician, but now we're in managed care. There are so many more things that it seems we have to be leery of. One comes to mind. I was in the supermarket just this past weekend, and the supermarket chain that I was in had a big sign, get your flu vaccine here. I mean, back in the 50s or 60s, it would have been almost unheard of,
right,
to get your vaccine at the local supermarket.
Right. Well, that's a movement to involve pharmacists, especially with flu vaccines, but to involve pharmacists in the provision of vaccinations, and that's been a significant move very recently. And I think it demonstrates the problems of a private health system in the service of public health. So that's pretty interesting. In the 1950s, when the polio vaccine was being tested, and then when it was rolled out, there was a lot of vaccination in schools, and some areas do continue to do in-school flu vaccination clinics. That happens when there's a sort of immediate concern. So in 2009. 2010, when there was the most recent H1N1 pandemic, there were a lot of school districts across the country that had public provision of flu vaccine.
A lot of your book focuses on the apprehension that many people in general, but especially if you're a parent of young children, and I certainly understand that. If you've got young children, you want to make sure that whatever vaccines, if that be the case, that they're getting is indeed going to benefit them and not harm them in any way. But let me ask you, why? I mean, everybody will tell you, there's no finer medicine than right here in the United States. People come from far and wide to receive treatment of all kinds here in this country. So why is there so much skepticism among citizens?
Well, there are a lot of drivers of that skepticism. The book sort of traces a number of different sort of cultural threads, you might say. Distrust of pharmaceutical companies and the profit motive in vaccine production, distrust of bureaucratic government and the notion that elites in government are not looking out for the ordinary citizen, alienation from government in the sense that citizens feel like they lack a voice in making decisions that affect their health. So those are some of the drivers. There's also, as I said before, this concern that that there are too many vaccines given to children when they're very young. And that's the way I like to think about that particular concern is that scientists and physicians will tell you that there is no the number of vaccines is not a cause for concern, and that they're safe and effective. So there may not be a biological limit to the number of vaccines that we can give to children, but there may be a social limit. There may be a social limit in terms of what parents are willing to inject their children with. There are also concerns about what's in vaccines, right? So the concerns about thimerosal, which was a mercury derivative preservative used in multi-dose vials of vaccines that's been eliminated from children's vaccines. Aluminum is used as an adjuvant. In other words, it kind of boosts the effectiveness of vaccines. And some people are concerned about the aluminum in vaccines. There's a concern about how the vaccines are made, the kinds of tissues that the viruses that are grown on that make the vaccine. So there's a range of issues across these concerns about contamination and potential chronic illness that will result from vaccines, from the sort of political economy of vaccines.
And everything, Bernice, that you just mentioned would run through my mind. I'm sure they run through your mind, and I'm going to venture to say that most adults, again, if you're a parent, especially if you're a parent with young children, those should be concerns. But again, I want to go back because again, it's a theme that constantly comes through in your book is this hesitation on the part of people who may not have a full trust. I mean, people think, well, the FDA said it's okay. I mean, two schools of thought here, two camps, I should say. The FDA said it's okay, so if they think it's okay, then I'm on board. Other people are very skeptical of that. But something you said earlier also kind of resonates with me, and that is the fact that pharmaceutical companies have been known to pay, you know, there's been kickbacks, let's call it what it is, to either political parties or individual politicians for supporting a certain bill that would promote their product. You know, it's part of, you know, it's part of the economy here. So how do you ever know, you know, or should you put, I guess the question is, should you put full trust in what the government tells us?
Well, that's one of the big questions that my book raises. I don't raise it in quite the same way. The way that I raise that question is to sort of say people don't often trust the government to have their best interests in mind. And it's interesting because one of the things that I look at in the book that kind of taught me that was a really important issue in vaccine skepticism was when I studied zombie novels and films. Initially, I looked at sort of zombie fiction as because so much of it is so much of the sort of zombie apocalypse is caused by a kind of vaccine or virus gone awry, and so that's why I started to think about studying zombie fiction as a part of the book. But really, what I came away from after I had explored the genre was that this persistent theme that in the zombie apocalypse, the government is going to make a decision to save civilization, and that means sacrificing some citizens to the zombies, because that's sort of the way the calculus works. And it's a kind of a plot device through a number of texts. And so that expresses this deep cultural concern that when the chips are down, the government is not necessarily going to protect you.
And that's a valid reason for anybody, either for themselves or for their children, to take a step back and be skeptical, ask a lot of questions. And I'm sure you know as I do, either friends, neighbors, whatever it may be, some are on board with any vaccine, believing that, you know, this is in the best interest of themselves and their children. Others question, you know, everything from start to finish. You know, so you never really get everybody all into one camp. I want to come back and continue in that train of thought, but I want to take a quick pause to let folks know that you're listening to 90.5 WICN, Jazz Plus for New England. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Listen online at wicn.org. I'm Al Vohner, and this is The Public Eye. My guest this week is author and educator Bernice Hausman. Her new book is Anti-Vax, Reframing the Vaccination Controversy. And I think every one of us, I said earlier, at one time or another has been faced with the question, do I get a vaccine? Should I have my children vaccinated for whatever? Bernice, I guess another thing that I've always thought about, but it came through more clearly after reading your book, is the fact that, I use my own youth as a starting point. I don't recall having as many issues, medical issues out there or things that we have to protect ourselves from as we do today. Is that because we just weren't aware of it? Because it seems like, as you said, that there could probably be vaccine for almost everything and anything. It wasn't quite that, you know, prevalent back then. What's going on? Is it just a society, because there's more and more people, we live close together more so now than ever before, that we share germs more? I mean, what's causing the need for all these vaccines?
Well, infectious disease. I mean, the diseases that that vaccines prevent against, none of them are really new. I mean, they are, you know, there are emerging infectious diseases like Ebola, and there are attempts to create vaccines against those. But all of the diseases that vaccines prevent against, like measles, mumps, rubella, chickenpox, hepatitis A, hepatitis B, all of those diseases have existed. What's changed has been the capacity to prevent them through vaccination. And I'm not the only one doing this research. There's a great historian, Elena Conis, who wrote a book called Vaccine Nation. And that book really sort of looks historically at the period from the Kennedy presidency in the early 1960s through to the early 2000s, and demonstrates, I think, really persuasively that that, for example, when the vaccines for measles and mumps emerged were developed in the 1960s, parents had to be convinced that measles and mumps were serious diseases that needed to be vaccinated against, because until that time, all the entire birth cohorts got those diseases as children, right? And it was considered a kind of a routine rite of passage in childhood. And the same thing happened in the 1990s when they rolled out the chickenpox vaccine. I had the chickenpox. My siblings had the chickenpox. My children, who were born in the mid-90s, they had the chickenpox as well. They were the last cohort of children to really to get the chickenpox as toddlers. And so what we have actually is a developing set of technologies that, and now, of course, they use recombinant technologies to engineer vaccines in very sophisticated ways. So you have diseases that we once thought of as mild and routine are now thought of as very dangerous, in part because the vaccines were developed and we can prevent them.
The medical industry, I think sometimes people don't understand that it is still a profit-driven industry, tremendous profits, depending on what area of your medicine you're working within. But I would imagine the drug development, vaccine development, you know, everything that comes under that, you know, that umbrella, certainly has a tremendous profit potential. Again, in the book, you talk a lot about, you know, there's a lot of naysayers, but are they basing their negative impression on real facts or you know, solid information, or just hearsay from media or other people? Let me ask you: are the drug companies themselves, the people that are introducing these vaccines, the drugs behind all of that, should they be held accountable to some degree for some of this brouhaha, this doubtfulness that a lot of people have in their minds because one wants to be a step ahead of the next company?
So it's really hard to figure out how to address that problem given the structure of sort of drug making, right? It's private industry, and so do you sort of cast aspersions on the entire industry and say these people are manipulative and they fudge evidence and they're only interested in profit and they don't care about people's health? It's hard for me to be that cynical. And also, I also should point out that one of the things I try to do in my book is not at any point sort of definitively say, you know, yes, these companies are bad,
right?
But rather to point out that we have scholars, doctors, and scientists who have written books exposing the problems of evidence in pharmaceutically funded research, the problems of trust that we have given some of the really big sort of scandals involving the pharmaceutical industry. I mean, when you look now at the opioid crisis, it makes perfect sense that people would distrust pharmaceutical companies given the way that those companies that produced opioids sort of flooded the market and helped to create drug dependence that we see now in our society. So what I try to argue is that, you know, it makes sense that people would have a certain amount of distrust. But what I try not to do is to sort of come out and then sort of argue that we should have that distrust, because my arguments are based on understanding the cultural context, but not making definitive statements about the dangers of vaccines or the safety of vaccines, for example.
I think a lot of times, at least for me personally, you know, J&J has just been they've been through court, they've been through litigation for quite a while now, Merck. I mean, at some point in time, it seems each and every one of the pharmaceutical companies, as you said, these private industry companies that are responsible for the development of many of the drugs that go into these vaccines, and have been taken to task, whether it's by the government agency or by private individuals. And once that's out there, Bernice, once that's on the front pages of papers, and, you know, today with social media, and, you know, so much of what we get today is, you know, is skewed one way or the other. You come away thinking, oh, geez, I'm not sure what to do here. And I'm just wondering how many children, again, I go back to children because I think they're the most vulnerable, you know, part of society when it comes to vaccines. When parents hear all that negativity, but don't bother to go beyond that, just take that at face value, and then decide that they don't want their children to have any vaccines at all. You know, how much risk is out there, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. How many children are at risk because of all this negativity and this lack of getting the facts before making a decision? Is that pretty prevalent?
So I guess you're asking sort of two questions, and I'll take the one about how many children are not vaccinated first. Interestingly enough, so the number of children who receive no vaccines in this country is small proportion in comparison to the number who receive some or all vaccines. Very, very small, so less than 2%. And children are less likely to be vaccinated if they're on public assistance, or they live in what are called non-metropolitan statistical areas, which, in other words, rural areas.
Right.
So you see there that one of the biggest problems with vaccine attainment is lack of access. So that voluntary non-vaccinators are actually, they're a small proportion, but their proportion among the children who are not vaccinated is growing. So in other words, that as federal assistance for vaccination and the Vaccines for Children Act in 1993 and then the Affordable Care Act established provision for vaccination for poor children, you actually have a decreasing number of children who have lack of access over time, and therefore among the children who don't get any vaccines, the proportion of children who don't get vaccines because their parents voluntarily hold them back is growing slightly larger. But that whole number, you know, proportionally in the U.S. population, is still quite small.
Yeah. And I guess, you know, I think, you know, in hindsight, when you look at the big picture, you know, many, many, many children, as well as adults, have benefited from, you know, from these vaccines. Otherwise, it certainly would have been an issue delved into much more deeply. So I guess that, you know, when I got done with the book, I thought, you know, overall, I'm not going to say that vaccines are bad, but I think, as I've been saying right along this evening, that you know, before people make any kind of decision, and I think you would agree, get the facts, get as much information as you can. Don't just say yay or nay until you do that.
Well, that's an interesting point, though, because vaccines are not a private health matter. They're a public health matter. And as a result, even though getting information is perceived to be the sine qua non of good medical stewardship and how to take care of yourself and be personally responsible, with respect to vaccination, there's a lot of concern about what happens when parents try or individuals try to get information. If they get the quote wrong information, especially from the internet, they're excoriated and criticized. And so one of the questions comes: how do we talk about what information gathering means with respect to vaccination? Because vaccination, especially of children, is enforced through school entry mandates in the states, and there's increasing concern about states that have liberal laws that allow parents to opt their children out of vaccination easily for personal beliefs. And so that's part of where the political tension is in the country right now, these sort of questions around how much decision-making parents and others really have about vaccination and what kind of information is valid.
It is indeed an issue that's not going to go away anytime soon. It's certainly open for discussion, and your book certainly keeps it out there on the front lines, which is very, very important. Anti-Vax: Reframing the Vaccination Controversy is the new book by Bernice Hausman. Bernice, if people want to get more information, your work, your research, how can they reach you? Is there a website? Is there an email?
Website's under construction, so it's not available yet, but you can find my information at the Penn State College of Medicine website, especially the Department of Humanities pages. Book is available on Amazon and from Cornell University Press.
Yeah, and again, as I said, Bernice has written a book that I think helps people. It gives people some direction. Helps people get into what's going on with this controversy. What's up with vaccines, regardless of what side of the aisle you're on. I think it's just a great read and a way of getting more information and just helping to make a better decision on this issue, which affects everybody. None of us are immune to this thing. So it's, and especially as I said earlier, and Bernice said the same thing. I mean, there was, throngs of young children, and we need to do right by them. If you have any questions about the broadcast this evening, you can certainly give us a call here at the studios at WICN. Our main number is 508-752-0700. You can pose any comments, questions, or feedback to me directly. I certainly welcome that. That's Al Vona, V-U-O-N-A, at WICN.org. For the public eye, this is Al Vona.